Dirk Seibert. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi,
hey, y'all. It's good to be here sober with everyone today. I typically don't get real nervous. I was a little bit nervous this morning, and I don't know if anyone else noticed it, but as Dwayne came up here in red and Jason backed up over here, there's some sunlight came through there, and it was kind of like God shining on Jason, and I thought, you know, boy, if there's anybody in this room that needs that, that'd be Jason. We're both a mess, fortunately we have strong sponsorship that keeps us somewhat in line. My sobriety date is October 15th, 1989. I have a home group. It's the Fellowship Group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Huntsville, Alabama. We have four meetings a day, every day. So if you're ever in Huntsville and want to go to a meeting, there's no excuse for not going to a meeting. I have a sponsor. I've had the privilege of having two sponsors since I've been in this fellowship. I keep it pretty simple. My first sponsor's name was Jimmy. My second sponsor's name is Jim. And I think I'm a member of the, one of the main things that makes me a member of this wonderful fellowship is not just the fact that I have a home group, that I have a sobriety date, but that I have a sponsor and that I try to work the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to thank the committee for having me here. Milton and Joanne, just lovely people. The rest of the folks who I've been seeing scurrying around all weekend, taking care of our coffee and our snacks. And when the power goes out, they go get generators, and the power comes back on, and they just have done a lovely job. I don't know about y'all, but I don't think we should have idols, but we certainly have heroes. Back early in my sobriety, I heard Milton and Joanne talk. Then I got to be with them again in a roundup. And if all of you that have heard Milt talk, it's a very clear message about this program. And it's something that really helped me early on and continues to help me. And I noticed this weekend when I was running around in my jeans and sweatshirt, every time I look up and stuff, there's Milton kind of looking at me, you know? And I'm thinking, I better behave. I think he's watching me. And I don't know if Walt told him to keep his eye on me or what, but I just got that feeling. It's probably mistaken. The program up until this time has been wonderful. Phil just did a beautiful job, I think, Friday night. I spoke with him afterward, and there's about three or four things in particular that I identified with. And that's what this deal is all about. I connected there. Then I got to hear his bride, Teresa, talk, and I realized that the only reason Phil is here is because Teresa was asked to come, because she just delivered a powerful Al-Anon message, something that I've been particularly interested in lately, and hopefully I can share a little bit about that. When J.D. talked last night, the guy has a wonderful gift of humor and delivering a great message. And then his heartfelt sharing at the end just really touched me. I want to thank you for that. A lot of y'all wondering, I guess, after hearing these wonderful speakers, if you're going to have to sit there for an hour listening to this monotone, slow drawl talk. And yes, you are. I think I have, according to what the big book says, I have a spiritual disease or spiritual malady. And it's a hopeless state of mind and being when I got here. I can authenticate that, verify that based on my experience. Ergo, as the smart people say, if I have a spiritual disease or spiritual malady, I need a spiritual solution. Without that, I'm out of luck. There is no hope for me. Based on what the big book says about real alcoholics, of which I believe I qualify as a real alcoholic, Alcoholics Anonymous is the greatest movement in the world for helping people like me. There are other things that help people get sober, stay sober. Alcoholics Anonymous has worked for me. So I think what God gave me through Alcoholics Anonymous is this spiritual path, this solution that is 12 simple steps that can sometimes be excruciatingly painful to work. But I can stand before you and tell you that when I first worked them, and I did the best I could, and it wasn't so hot, but I have not had to have a drink since then. And I continue to try to work that program. Because I feel so strongly about AA, I think it's very, very important that we preserve the singleness of purpose. We do one thing very, very well here. We fix drunks, as Bill W. says. And I think that's all we need to do. There is nothing more deeper wrong with me spiritually than my disease of alcoholism. There's a lot of stuff wrong with me, but there is nothing more important for me to address than my disease of alcoholism. So I think this singleness of purpose that I get from AA is so important that we preserve that. I think we need to continue to try to deliver a clear message that the book has provided for us. You know, sometimes when I go to meetings, I'm 17 years sober. Too often, I have the most sobriety. I don't like that. I kind of like it when I get to look around. I got the most sobriety, but I don't like that. The book says God would like us to keep our head up in the clouds, but he says, get your feet on the ground. So this message is to you long-timers, both AA and Al-Anon. You are the people that can continue to help us, people like me and people that come in. You know, people that come in AA, they don't know if this is a Hare Krishna thing. They don't have any clue what this deal is. If they were like me, even if they've been through treatment and were taking some meetings, I was so foggy. I went to a lot of meetings, but it was kind of like a dream. So I think it's so terribly important when people like me go to meetings who am really struggling a lot of times. And for people that are brand new coming here, they see the long-timer, both AA and Al-Anon. I just think it's critically important that those folks continue to be at the meetings to ensure that this program stays as it was meant to be. And that's the end of my sermon, hopefully. I'm no particular special drunk. I felt ill at ease, felt like I didn't fit in. When I found alcohol, I just felt better. Silkworth describes it better than anyone else can describe it. I was restless, I was irritable and discontent. And I liked the ease and comfort that alcohol gave me. I'm one of those people that it provided me exactly what I needed to feel better about myself and to feel better about you. I rocked along up until my middle 30s, using every ounce of energy I had to do what I could to perform, as the big book told me later on, I perform. It says, more than most, the alcoholic leads a double life. And I tell you what, I don't know about y'all, but it takes a lot of willpower to act like you know what's going on, and growing up and in school and in sports and in jobs, when you're just terrified. I was just terrified. I was confused. And the way I approached it was, I took the offensive. I went after you where if there was any doubts or something, that if you were going to question me on anything, you knew there was going to be a pretty good price to pay. I towed the line. I did well scholastically. I got a job before I got out of college without going and looking for a job. I got another job after I didn't want that job. I wound up in Huntsville, Alabama in 1978 with unbelievable potential and scared to death. I met a lady, got married in 1988, and I had arrived. We bought us a little house down in a nice part of town. We both had good jobs. Neither one of us had children. We rocked and we rolled, man. We had a big time. My drinking progressed about like it should. I was one of those where the people that talked about the instant blackout drinkers and stuff like that, I just constitutionally wasn't able to handle that. I had to practice for quite a few years to get this alcohol stuff, the timing right, where everything would stay down long enough. I was just physically struggling with the alcohol. I finally got it right by the time I was about 35. And by right, I mean I turned into someone who all I wanted to do was be unconscious. I am a real alcoholic. When I start to drink, my last few years of drinking, nothing mattered but drinking. Absolutely nothing stood in the way. In 1984, I want to share experience with you. Doesn't make me an alcoholic, but it tells you the effects of what the disease of alcoholism has on me. I was working in this new assignment. I'd been promoted. I was 31 years old. We were working very hard. We had a little bit of quiet time. It was Secretary's Week. We decided, my little team that I was working with, a group of four or five of us, decided to take our secretary out to lunch for Secretary's Week because she was a fine person, fine employee. And we did. We went to lunch. We had a little bit of a lull. We had lunch, and then we had a few drinks. There was three of us, me and a co-worker and this lady named Faye. And we just talked, had just like anyone would do. It came time to take them back to their vehicle on post. I had driven that day. And when I went on to post shortly thereafter, I crossed the line, hit a car head on. I don't know if I was in blackout or a result of the accident. I don't remember what happened. But this is what happened. The lady, Faye, who was riding shotgun, was killed. I was busted up all the pieces. My buddy in the back seat was hurt. And the lady that I hit, who was heading home from work, was seriously hurt. So you're looking at a guy who on the outside looked like everything was put together, everything was going in the right direction, to my life instantaneously fell apart. One, I didn't know what to do about the responsibility of my friend's death. My blood alcohol content was well over the legal limit. I was charged with negligent homicide in federal court because it happened on a post. I was sued by everybody involved. I was in a wheelchair, busted up all to pieces. And I didn't know what to do. I really didn't know what to do. The hardest part was not the physical part of the rehab and the therapy and the surgeries and the hospitalization. The hardest part was when I was conscious thinking about my responsibility for what happened. I pled guilty to that finally and on a reduced charge. I went down to federal court. I mean, if you don't know what powerless is, I'll share with you a different form of powerlessness. When you're standing in front of a federal judge who has your whole life in your hands and you're standing up there getting ready to receive a sentence, that's powerless. He sends me 5 years in federal penitentiary. He gave me a fine, maximum amount. And he gave me community service. And the right reason he gave me a lot of community service is he suspended those 5 years. I never served a day in jail. All those legal liability suits were settled out of court. I skated on that like I've always skated. The one thing I did right in that is I did take responsibility legally best I could. I knew who was responsible for that incident. People looked at me and said, thank God that's over with. Now you can go on with the rest of your life. That was an accident. I had a lot of enablers. Man, I had people at the highest level where I work coming and testify for me as a character witness. I don't think I mentioned to them what kind of drinking I was doing at home during that time. I was completely and totally dishonest. I was leading that double life. That's all I could do. And there became a time after that period in 85 where I became acquainted with what the Big Book talks about, the terror, the bewilderment, the frustration, and despair. My drinking took on proportions that were just unimaginable to me up until that time, because that's all I could do. I ran just as long as I could, going to work, drinking, trying to act like a husband, and I finally ran out of energy and hope. I had something interesting happen in the late 80s. I said I need to take a month off from work. I was having a lot of depression, you know, and if you drank like I did, you'd have a lot of depression, and you'd be sick a lot. I was doing my best work when I was at work. Unfortunately, I wasn't at work all that much. And those people were enabling me. I started laying out, and I just couldn't come out of this drunk. And I was doing pretty good there, minding my own business. My wife would come home from her good job, and on the way home, she'd pick up some alcohol for me. Because, see, if I got picked up again drinking, my probation officer said he'd be more than happy to let me serve that five-year sentence. So my wife picked up something for me to drink, come home, cook a little something, and I'd try to get it down. And so I had a pretty good deal going on, because most of the time I was unconscious. I must have started making phone calls somewhere in there because my sister from Orlando showed up at the front door. She's 4 years older, and she's a take-charge kind of gal. So there's a lot of activity started going on at the house, but, you know, it wasn't too bad. My wife was still going to work. My sister would be gone all day, and about a week later, I was laying in bed minding my own business. It's a Saturday morning. They come got me out of bed, and when I got out of bed, there was two other people in the living room, one of whom was my big, big, big boss, who had testified for me as a character witness a couple years before, kind of sitting there looking at me. I weighed about 140 pounds. I was going to tell Phil, he said he weighed about a little over 100. I weighed about 99 pounds, I think, now, since he just weighed 100. But I weighed 140 pounds probably, and I was sick. Man, I was sick. I could barely hold my head up. These four people that loved me very much and took time out in their lives, their busy lives, they did not wait for me to ask for help. If they waited for me to ask for help, I don't know that would happen. They gave me an opportunity to make a decision. They said, you can either lose your job, you're going to be living somewhere else. My wife said she'd had about all me she could stand. Or you can go to this place that my sister had found. And I said to myself, you know, man, I need some help. And and I tell you, the only reason I said that, I don't know that it was the fear of the job and the financial stuff, because we were set financially, or all that stuff. I think there's one reason I said that to myself and surrendered to them for a moment. The alcohol quit working. I'd had a period of time in the last few days where just like many of us talk about, it just wouldn't shut down. It just wouldn't shut down the way it had been shutting down for those years. They sent me off to treatment. I graduated with honors at treatment. I took to it. I read that book, and there's one thing that I think really helped me. Before I went to treatment, I do need to back up. Before they sent me off to treatment, and when they had said about that, gave me that opportunity to make a decision, that intervention, I found out later what had happened. My sister is a research analyst kind of person. And, you know, I mentioned to you that my wife was coming home with my booze, and she was coming home with cooking me something to eat and taking care of me as I was pretty much an invalid. One day she came home, and I guess I turned invisible because there was no booze. There was no food. We had two couches in the living room. She sat on the other one. And I'm sitting there thinking, I remember consciously remember this part, that what's going on? Well, my sister, my wife's best friend, and my wife had gone to Al-Anon. And I had no idea what was going on in time, but my life changed. She never brought me anything to drink again. So I think Al-Anon saved my life, because I don't know that that would have quit if she hadn't learned from Al-Anon that she didn't have to do that. If that cat's going to drink himself to death, she didn't say it. Her action said, have at it, big boy. And then a few days later, that's when they gave me that option. When I graduated with honors there at the treatment center, and I read, because the one thing that gave me hope, when I read the first 164 pages, the only word or term or phrase that I recall is the allergy. You know, that was the first hint that I knew what my problem was. I didn't have a clue up to then. You know, it's this disease of alcoholism, there's many horrible things about it, but I think one of the most horrible things is to have it and not know what you got. I didn't know what my problem was. When they sentenced me to 5 years probation, I tell you what my solution to my drinking problem was. And I pitched this to my wife. I pitched this to my employers. I said, I'm going to drink still. I'll just quit driving. Never was a thought of stopping drinking. That is the power that alcohol has over me. I don't even know it. I'm a real alcoholic. I came out of that treatment center, hit AA, got a sponsor, went to meeting 6 days a week, 6 nights a week. My wife was doing Al-Anon. get in fellowship, doing stuff, woke up 6 months later upside down in the bed drunk. Nothing changed. There's no mention of the steps. There's no decision. So my experience has been that stopping drinking and going to AA will not work for me. It got so bad that I had to drink. You know, when I drank after almost 6 months of clean time, I didn't get up the next day and go to a meeting. I got up the next day, got in my car, went and got me something to drink, drank for 9 days. That's the type of alcoholic I am. I have no hope. Well, these people showed back up at my house, and in between me sneaking in the bathroom, drinking a little bit of Listerine and stuff, they convinced me that I needed to go back to AA. So after about those 9 days, it was a Sunday, I drove up, stopped by the Sports Page Lounge, got me a couple of vodka and orange juices, doubles, two of them. Went down to my group and got me a white chip. I haven't had a drink since. I don't know about that deal. So when I show up, see people showing up at my group drunk, when I start thinking, what the heck are they doing here? I forget sometimes. You know, there I'm sitting. Those people at my group, they didn't ask anything. They knew I was really struggling staying conscious and stuff. But when I said I need a white chip, you know what they did? Here's your white chip. Thank you. And had a drink since then. And here's the reasons that I think I've been so fortunate to have this grace that this action program gives me. You know, I believe Alcoholics Anonymous keeps me sober if I'm willing to take the efforts. Tom Brady talked about efforts, results, efforts, results. This is an action program. I got a sponsor. His name was Jimmy Lusk. I did a third step somewhere in there because the only reason I know that is I took inventory to him after a few months of working with him. Another friend, John G. from Huntsville, now living in Birmingham, told me about the book, A New Pair of Glasses. And that's where I got my initial conception of a God of a personal nature. I had always seen the goodness or the God in you people in AA and Al-Anon, but I got it of a personal nature when I read about Chuck C's talking about his being a father, and no matter what his children did, he may not approve of what they did, but he would never ever stop loving them. So I believe that no matter what kind of mess I make, and I make a lot of messes, I made a lot drunk and I make a lot sober, I think my Father loves me unconditionally. I think the power of love and forgiveness are the two most powerful forces known. And I believe that based on the experience that I've received through Alcoholics Anonymous. When I took inventory to Jimmy, I noticed something that was critically important. For the first time in my life, I noticed something about me. I was no longer the victim. I no longer had the bad breaks. I no longer had a horrible father. Because when I looked at the right-hand side of the columns toward the end of my inventory, I saw something horribly, terrifyingly wonderful. The bad news is, no matter the situation that I was in, I was always selfish, I was always dishonest, I was always self-seeking, I was always inconsiderate, I was always frightened. No matter what was over there on the left-hand side of the column, it didn't matter who or what was over there. That was the way I responded and reacted to life. The good news is, you folks said there's something I can do about that. The real magic for me happened in the ninth step. Several things had happened to me as a result of that accident. One, there's a family up in Tennessee that was very, very disappointed that I was not in prison for a long, long time. They took away my security clearance. Jobs and assignments I had required a security clearance. That wonderful job I had, I lost it. I did not get fired from the federal government because they can't hardly do that. You know, as long as, since I wasn't incarcerated, I was a convicted felon. My family, my mother, my father at the time was in his 70s. My family worried about me. My wife was halfway nuts. Up until this time, even though I'd quit drinking. The ninth step allowed me to mend those harms. I want to share with you a couple of them. They're critically important in my life. I don't think what I was told by my sponsor and another guy that I trusted just completely is that if you don't get right for that car accident, you will not stay sober. They did not say just keep coming to meetings, it'll be all right. They said, if you cannot come to terms with that, you will not stay sober. And I said, how would I do that? And they said, I don't know. So that's really about it. So I, my boss at the time knew that family up in Fayetteville, Tennessee. I said, boss, I need to go talk to that family. Will you go ask them if I can come talk to them? And he did, and they said yes. I drove up there one afternoon unannounced, and I wasn't going to their house. I knew they had a business. They had a skating rink up there. I stopped by there. I'm a year or so sober, scared to death. Walk in there, introduce myself, and ask for family members. And one, the mother and one of the sisters was there. There was a mother, father, two sisters that I needed to talk to. I introduced myself to the mother and sister. You folks told me how to make amends from the big book, and that's what I did. And I said, I really need to talk to the father, your husband, and the other sister, if I could do that. Because the father was the one that was down in that courthouse that day when I walked out of there. And I tell you, if looks could kill, you'd have a different speaker today, because the poor man had lost his oldest daughter from a drunken driver, and he was walking on home. I needed to talk to him. You know, they invited me back to their home. I went back up there about a week later, and I sat in their living room. It was the two sisters and the mom and dad. And I made amends to them. Let me tell you what love and forgiveness power is. Do you know what they did? They thanked me. And I said, part of this deal is making them is to try to see if there's anything I can do that can make this right. And I know that is impossible, but I'm going to ask anyway. And they said, you know what happened that the last day is we do not know what Faye's last day was like. You were with her all day, and I was with her from 7 in the morning till 4:30 that afternoon. And they said, we'd all lawyered up. There was no discussion back and forth. There was just, you know, people were wanting retribution. I was wanting to get out of it. You know, I had the gift and the opportunity to share with them about that day. They hugged me and they thanked me and they forgave me. The gift I have gotten from that is in AA, there are a lot of us that have been in similar circumstances, oftentimes worse. And if someone comes up to you as a sponsor and starts talking to you about how am I going to deal with that, and if you don't know, what I've had the opportunity to do is talk to a lot of men and women that are wanting to know what to do about that. And what's really wonderful about AA, and they come to me and they tell me about some fatality result of their drunkenness, they say, what do I do? I say, I don't know. Here are the things that I did. And then they can go do whatever they, and their God can work out. I had a father that I hated. I got to go make amends to him. I was a crappy, selfish, self-centered, not their son. A few months before he died, he was 84 at the time. As I was making amends to him, I was helping him undress because he was getting pretty feeble. He was very robustly healthy until about 83, and then he got real sick. And I was helping him undress so he could go to the bathroom, and I was making my amends to him. And it was in this room, in this house, that the memories were not too good. You know what that man said to me? He said the kindest thing I ever heard. He said, boy, I don't know what you ever thought you could have done to harm me. And this is from the guy who had a son when he was 50 years old almost, and I was not there as a son. So we got to spend a little bit of time together. Love and forgiveness is just... AA showed me something that is can't happen. God does the impossible. God does the impossible. All I have to be willing to do is to try to do the possible. I can't do that. AA shows me how to do that. I didn't have a security clearance. I was a convicted felon. I went to the security people in the arsenal. There's about 15,000 people working out there at the time. I said, you know, I'm sober. I got acquainted with this guy named Monty who ran the security part. I said, I want my security clearance back. So they gave me a regulation. I said, well, I'd like to talk to somebody that's got the security clearance back. They said, well, we don't know anybody. I said, okay. So I went to my sponsor and I said, what do I do? He said, well, why don't you just see what the securities, the regulation says, rather, and why don't you just follow the instructions? And I hadn't thought of that. And it's a bureaucratic monster. I really wound up writing my life story. I told him the whole deal. I told him about taking responsibility for that, going to treatment, getting drunk, getting back in AA. I told him everything. And got it endorsed. And I wrote, when I went back and read this thing, and I go back and read it once in a while, it is a pretty doggone good writing. I can't write. I'm not a good writer. Never been a good writer. This was a good package. I got endorsed up through the chain. Absolutely no encouragement. No one came and talked to me. No one interviewed me. I just put it all together. I had everything in there. I had my thing from charter, you know, showed where I graduated from there. And I had people from AA write letters. You know, they didn't say AA. And I had other people write letters. Sent this thing off up to Fort Meade, Maryland. No one encouraged me one bit. No one said anything positive the whole time I did it. They sent me back a letter about 60 days later and said, your security clearance has been reinstated. All they wanted me to do was be sober. I was, as I mentioned, convicted felon, couldn't vote. I like politics. I like to vote. That way I can speak my mind everywhere but in AA. I went down to Montgomery. I petitioned for a pardon. I was getting ready to walk in before that. I did used the same thing I did. I went down to Montgomery. Before I went down to Montgomery, I bought my new suit, my new briefcase, new tie, looking really good. Mailed in this package, and what you do, you go before this board of nine people. You know, you petition them. So I was waiting there, and they called my name, and there's a bailiff there at the front door, at the door, and then inside's the panel. So I'm getting my new briefcase, getting my new jacket, and I walk up there, and that bailiff stops me, says, "They approved your pardon. It'll be in the mail. Thank you for coming down." And I came so, this is the arrogance and the ego when things go my way. I thought, I need to go in there and talk to those people about it. And I had just enough sense to say, "Thank you." Piece by piece, Alcoholics Anonymous allowed me to mend the damage that I did, not only with those people, but with my mother, my sister, the other employers, the other relationships that I had damaged or destroyed. The power of love and forgiveness that Alcoholics Anonymous gave me is just unquestionable based on my experience, and indescribable. I've made a lot of mistakes in sobriety. Gail and I I decided I didn't want to be married to Gail, it's the honest truth. We got divorced. It was very difficult. I tell you what Al-Anon and AA did, we did that in spite of all the difficulties, in spite of all the damage I did exactly what I said I was going to do. She did exactly what she said she was going to do. I had to go back and make amends to her later, and I made direct amends to her for that divorce and for my deal, and we are very good friends now. She's been remarried, and she's got a husband that, he's a lot better husband than I'll ever be. So it just kind of works out. I had a second marriage. Lasted about 15 minutes, which is quite a while. Seemed like 18 months or so, and didn't work out. I made a mess. I just made a mess. She was in the program. We thought we were lifetime partners. And it seemed like a lifetime because I just couldn't do it. I made a mistake. You know, you don't get drunk by making mistakes. Get drunk when you want to admit you made it and try to do the best you can to fix it. That's what I did. I did the best I could to fix it. Then I did something I've never done before, and this is something important too for me. After that situation, for the first time in my life, I was out of a relationship without having the next one lined up. I was 46 or 7 years old. For the first time since my teens, the next one wasn't on deck. There was no one on deck. And I don't know if that second one just wore me out and scared me so much, or if that I was growing up a little bit and seeing what, getting a little bit more honest about what I was and what I wasn't. Because this has nothing to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not in the book. I just said to myself, "Boy, you need to stay away from these women for a while." And it went, so the year, that's a definitive period that's pretty recognizable. So I said, "I need to try this puppy for a year." And that was a very, very difficult year. Fortunately for me, I was very active in AA. All this time, I go to a lot of meetings. When I first got sober, I'd go to 10 a week. Now I'm down to 3 or 4 a week. Sometimes I'll go to more than that. That year, I just dove into AA. Every sick man in North Alabama showed up at my house. None of them stayed sober. Me and my sponsor worked with them. We stayed sober. My sponsor at the time, Jimmy Luss, got real sick. our roles had kind of reversed. He had about 17 years sober. This man, we had absolutely nothing in common. He was a rough, raw bone, uneducated, didn't work kind of guy. He was financially independent. We had absolutely nothing in common. And he turned into the best, closest friend I will ever have in my life. I had him as a sponsor for 10 years. So I don't know. I found someone that intimidated me, and I didn't think I could impress, or but just enough sense to know that I was going to work a deal if I could, and I knew that I couldn't with this character because I just couldn't do it. So Jimmy, like a lot of us, is like all of us is human. He made some bad decisions, and he got in a really bad place. His first sponsor, Hal, had died, who we were both very close to. He was trying to work the steps with another sponsor. He's going to a lot of meetings. And, you know, I started going over and spending the weekend with Jimmy. And I've never seen anybody in such pain. He wasn't drinking. But the atmosphere of the depression and the hopelessness would get so strong in that house, I would have to leave the house, go outside and smoke my cigar because it was just overwhelming. One weekend it was so bad I was scared to leave him. I took him and put him in the psych ward in Crestwood. I called Bo that weekend. We didn't know what to do. So I talked to Bo. I talked to a physician that I was sponsoring at the time, and I went and locked my sponsor up in the psych ward. He seemed to be getting a little bit better, and he came out of it. I went and got him, took him back home. Seemed to be getting a little bit better. And one day, we were talking, and he wasn't feeling so good. And we were talking on the phone one Tuesday evening, and he said, I said, what's going on? He said, I don't feel good. I said, well, why don't you come over tomorrow, and we'll eat dinner, and we'll go to a meeting, which was our habit to do on occasion. On Wednesday was a regular meeting for me. And he says, okay. And he said, I love you, and he hung up. And about 2 hours later, his ex-wife called me. Jimmy had made a decision. He hung up that phone after talking to me, got in the car, rode down a couple roads at this intersection where traffic was, and he just blew his head off. And that's just what happened. He couldn't see any way out. So I had the opportunity to bury and eulogize Jimmy on my 10th AA birthday. And thank God there's people in AA that said, let's go back to AA, step over the grave, as other people have said, and that's what I did. And I searched all over for a circuit speaker kind of sponsor, and I was staying in my home group one day at the coffee bar, and there was this guy that we got sober. He got sober a little bit before I did. He goes to 5 meetings a week. I've been seeing him in meetings forever, and I look over him. I said, you're my new sponsor, and his name was Jim, and he's been my sponsor ever since. People get really sick in Alcoholics Anonymous just because they have some sobriety. And they get either emotionally, mentally, or physically sick. Do not leave those people. When Hal got sick, I got to drive him around. He went blind. He couldn't see. Jimmy got sick. I got to spend some time with him. Just did what we could. He made a decision. It turns out everything was arranged. He had bought the flowers. He had bought the casket. He'd got everything set up. He made a decision. So that's not my deal. That's between him and God. He saved my life, best friend I ever had. Truly, truly miss him with all my heart. So during this time, all this same stuff's going on. I'm not dating. All these crazy guys are showing up. We had a little Joe and Charlie study on the weekend. I mean, this is intense stuff. we got the tapes, we got the book. There was me and my sponsor and seven other guys, so that's nine of us. It was a spend the night weekend. Well, we had, the first night, we had about an 87% recovery rate. We listened the first night, and a guy sneaked off after that first thing and got drunk. So I thought, well, that's not too bad. And we went, we did the next day, we got up, did the whole thing just like Joe and Charlie, and went to a speaker meeting that night and finished up on Sunday. And you know, I don't know if any of those seven guys stayed sober. I've lost track of a couple of them. I know five of those seven did not stay sober. Me and old Jim stayed sober. We just trying to carry the message, and it kept me out of myself. You know, if they're still living, maybe they'll get sober one day. It's going to a lot of meetings, it's going all over the place, you know. I'm living all by myself with my dog. And I'm lonely and depressed half the time, and I look at him, and heck, it's not his fault, you know. Must be mine. So I'm getting really familiar with some things about myself. When I'm uncomfortable or ill at ease or whatever, I'm living with myself. I don't have any relationships. Maybe it's me, you know, maybe it's me, which is that same process of the spiritual recovery from this disease. At the end of agnostics, it says, when we drew closer to him, he disclosed himself to us. I believe that. If I'm willing to draw near to him by this 12-step process, and by this carrying the message, I'm connected. I may not know I'm connected, but I'm connected. I have the power. My problem has always been I have no power. No one takes it from me. I give it away. You guys gave me the power. So this year passed, and I'm going to a lot of meetings, and I'm going to my home group. And then we were, at this time, we're having more meetings set up, coming about in the Huntsville area. And I noticed everywhere I go to this meeting, there's the same gal there. So I start talking to people, and they said, yeah, she's stalking you. And I said, well, she's cute. Is she married? Well, she's in the process of divorce. She got any kids? No. She's sober? Yeah. So, okay. So, next night I go to meeting, there she is. I got her schedule down pretty good. And it's Renee. We got together 3 years ago this month, and we got married 2 years ago this month. It's been interesting. I don't know, you know, this being married to someone sober and me trying to get sober is, I don't do good relationships. You know, that the book is real clear on that. The alcoholism and the relationships, they just, it's very tough. It is for me. And I'm trying, and we are trying, and we're growing, and we are struggling, and we are having good times, and we're having not so good times. But I love Renee with all my heart, and I have a feeling for her like I don't know that I've had for anyone else. We're seeing a counselor who's in 12-step program, strong in that. So we've been seeing her individually as a couple. And I'm explaining to this counselor, who I really trust, know a lot about her, trust her implicitly, And I explained to her all of Renee's faults. She said, "You need to go to Al-Anon." And I said, "But you know, Renee's been doing," she said, "You need to go to a lot of Al-Anon." And I took her advice. 4 months ago, I started going to Al-Anon. I go to 2 Al-Anon meetings a week. And Bo talked to me a little bit about it. I'm so grateful for him giving me a real clear message there, a real clear direction. You don't take away from AA. I do my AA, and I'm doing my Al-Anon in addition to. I'm 17 years sober going in Al-Anon, and I'm wondering, I wonder what they're talking about. And I'm hearing the words, and I'm understanding them. As far as the application of that stuff, I'm hearing the words, and I'm understanding them. And I'm really digging it. I love the people there. We have 50% men in our group. And they've been there for a while. They're not like me, new. Most of them are all Al-Anon, but there are a few double winners there. I got one of those guys as a sponsor. I've got a home group. I'm going to Wednesday night, Saturday morning Al-Anon meetings. Take Renee with me sometime. I'm not saying she needs it or anything. I'm just saying she take her with me. Let her meet the people. And that has been such a wonderful deal. I'm so new in it, I hadn't a clue. And my sponsor says, you know, he's been sober 15 years and Al-Anon 5 years. And he says, "You will not believe how excruciating slow this is." And I said, "Okay, thank you." And I love the people. I love the readings. I love the meetings. I like to think it's going to help me. I'm willing. I am willing. So that's why I have a particular interest not only in AA long-timers and Al-Anon long-timers continuing to be active in this program, because we need that message. You know, people like me coming there with 17 years of 12-step recovery may think he knows what's going on. And I had an Al-Anon guy that came up to me and he said, and my sponsor had said this too, I can't remember which one said it first, it says, "Dirk, listen, and they didn't say this, but I got the message, you ain't got anything to share in Al-Anon." So I went 30, 45 days and never said a word except my name. And I got that from people that had been around for a while. Somebody with a year in Al-Anon wouldn't have never come up to this guy and said that. But these long-timers came up to me and said, "You just be quiet and listen. That's your job." I got it. This job that I had, these people that kept me on this job when I really couldn't produce a lot, the result of Alcoholics Anonymous, they send me all over the world to do my job. I get to represent the United States Army, try to help the soldiers a little bit from Korea to Southwest Asia to Afghanistan. I've been to all those places. They send me there to try to help. I can't help. Alcoholics Anonymous gave me that gift. I got a mom, 79 years old. I'm a son to her. I never knew how to be a son. I show up to work pretty much when I'm supposed to show up to work, do what I'm pretty much supposed to do, try to earn my money. I heard a wonderful term Thursday night at the meeting. Eternal vigilance. Is that the right term? Eternal vigilance. This is work, folks. It is for me. It is a discipline that you have given me that does not dictate, is not dependent on if I want to do this or not. Yeah, I get to make a decision if I want to live sober, not if I want to do this or not. If I want to live sober, I get to do what AA allows me to do. What a gift. Trying to be a husband, trying to be a brother. I don't do too good at stuff like that, but I'm a lot better than I used to be when I was passed out on my bathroom floor. So, piece by piece by piece, by working the steps poorly a lot of times, I have begun giving a life from AA. AA keeps me sober. God gave me AA. I hear God through you. I see the goodness and godness in you. My job, I believe, is to share with others what I have been given. And I get to do that by having a home group, by having a sponsor, by trying to work the 12 steps and not telling anyone what to do, though I can lean toward that way. But I'm getting much better as a result of learning from you people, of sharing with them what I have done based on what other people have shared with them what they did. And I get to be sober all day today. And I get to be with people here on hallowed ground. This is not hallowed ground here at Monteagle because of the building and the property. It is because of the people that have come here and the experiences that they have had with other people here. And I feel so blessed to be a part of it. Thank you.